Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the UN's COP24 climate talks underway in Poland, in the middle of Polish coal country, on the continent of Europe, where a severe drought caused by climate change has Europe's major rivers at record low levels, such that cruise ships can no longer tour the Rhine. Jody Freeman, a professor and the founding director of the Environmental Law and Policy Program at Harvard Law School, who also served as counselor for energy and climate change in the Obama White House, joins us to discuss the reversal of the U.S.'s role from a champion of the Paris Agreement to the leader of the rejectionists and deniers of global warming. On Saturday, the U.S. joined Saudi Arabia and Russia in trying to minimize the dire International Panel on Climate Change's report on the approaching catastrophe of a 1.5 degrees Celsius rise in global temperature. Then on Monday, the U.S. hosted a panel touting the virtues of fossil fuels, promoting the fiction of clean coal, which was met with derisive laughter and protests from young activists shouting, "Shame on you," and "Keep it in the ground." Then we'll examine the worsening Brexit crisis in Britain as the political paralysis from this disastrous referendum moves from folly to farce, with Prime Minister May cancelling a vote in Parliament to ratify her unpopular Brexit deal with the European Union, which was facing certain, if not humiliating, defeat. Harold Clark, a professor in the School of Economic, Political and Policy Studies at the University of Texas at Dallas, and a visiting professor at the University of Manchester, whose latest book is Brexit: Why Britain Voted to Leave the European Union, joins us. Since it is highly unlikely May will get a better deal with the EU as the March 2019 Brexit deadline looms, we will discuss the growing possibility of a do-over referendum to end this self-inflicted nightmare promoted by Trump and covertly financed by Putin. Then finally, with Donald Trump tweeting out bald-faced lies that the U.S. is the only major country where global warming emissions went down last year, when the opposite is true, we will speak with Yohai Benkler, the faculty co-director of the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University and co-author of the new book Network Propaganda: Manipulation, Disinformation, and Radicalization in American Politics. He joins us to discuss the challenge for journalists covering the White House, where the occupant of the Oval Office has the bully pulpit but is a serial liar. Furthermore, Trump is kept in power by Rupert Murdoch, whose propaganda outfit Fox News continues to keep Trump supporters inside a bubble of delusion in which they are impervious to the facts and evidence, which have the majority of Americans in a state of alarm about what Trump is doing to the country and the world. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Jody Freeman, the Archibald Cox Professor at Harvard Law School and the founding director of the law school's Environmental Law and Policy Program. The co-author with Michael Gerard of Global Climate Change and U.S. Law, she also served as counselor for energy and climate change in the Obama White House. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jody Freeman.
Hi, Ian. Great to be with you.
Well, thank you, Jody. And just a couple of days ago, Donald Trump tweeted out some rather snide criticism of Emmanuel Macron facing these riots in Paris. And then he tweeted out a second tweet saying, "Very sad day and night in Paris. Maybe it's time to end the ridiculous and extremely expensive Paris Agreement and return money back to the people in the form of lower taxes. The U.S. was way ahead of the curve on that and the only major country where emissions went down last year." The problem with that statement, Jody, is that global warming emissions went up last year.
Yes, well, the president is full of falsehoods on the issue of climate change. He's just isolated himself from the international community. And, you know, this is a very important moment because there is a meeting of all of the countries of the world that have signed the Paris Agreement and made a commitment to try to control the world's rising temperature. And the U.S. Has put itself in a position where it's really the only country that has announced the intent to withdraw. And, you know, the international community is very disappointed. And they are really trying to make a point of this. And it's making the United States very uncomfortable to be put in this position. The leader of the free world taking a step back from its very important role in really getting this deal across the finish line, and yet the U.S. is not willing to come to the table and keep its commitment.
Well, just to be clear, it's not only a step back. The reality and the evidence is that global warming emissions were going down, and then when Trump came into office, they went back up again. So,
well, yeah. I mean, the larger picture, just to put some context here, you know, the U.S. is going to get some reduced emissions out of the fact that we are shifting to natural gas and away from coal because natural gas is cheaper. But for Trump to take credit for that is really the height of hypocrisy. I mean, that is a market dynamic. That's happening anyway on the ground. What he has done is take every possible step to frustrate any additional progress. So he is rolling back all of the federal government's policies that are designed to build on that trend. So he's rolling back the rules around power plant emissions of greenhouse gases, which was called the Clean Power Plan in the Obama years. He's rolling back the fuel efficiency standards that were going to help us make greater progress toward a transition to clean energy. He's basically taken every domestic step possible to frustrate any progress on climate change. So he shouldn't be boasting about the great progress that's being made quite apart from anything he's trying to do.
So does that mean that next year and probably the year after, as long as Trump is in power, the trend will go in the wrong direction and global warming emissions from the United States will increase?
Well, we are absolutely going in the wrong direction. I mean, look at what the president has done in response to the recent national climate assessment. I mean, this is a study that comes out every 4 years because U.S. law requires an updated assessment of the climate and its condition. And incidentally, the reason we do this is because George H.W. Bush, a Republican president, who, of course, passed away recently, he signed a law that required this ongoing assessment of climate change back in 1990. And the most recent of these reports concluded that the warming of the climate is unequivocal and that there would be upwards of $500 billion a year in cost to the U.S. economy by the end of the century. And this report is not some fringe report of a bunch of environmentalists. It's the report of the United States government. 13 federal agencies contributed to this report and over 300 experts. And the agencies involved in this are not the kind of only the environmental ones. The Department of Defense participated in this, the Department of Commerce, the Department of Energy, the Department of the Interior, and so on. And this is the official statement of the United States government about the seriousness of climate change. And the president's response to this was to go out to the press and say, I don't believe it. And to give an interview to the Washington Post in which he cited his high level of intelligence and said people like him with such high levels of intelligence don't believe this sort of thing. So this is his reaction to the report of his own government. And that is why the countries of the world are publicly recommitting themselves to Paris to try to point out the uniqueness of the American position in stepping away from it.
And again, I'm speaking with Jody Freeman, who is the Archibald Cox Professor at Harvard Law School and the founding director of the Law School's Environmental Law and Policy Program, the co-author with Michael Gerard of Global Climate Change and U.S. Law. She also served as counselor for energy and climate change in the Obama White House. But in not only did the U.S. have this meeting on Monday where they touted fossil fuels, in particular, clean coal, which is a complete fiction as far as I know. It simply doesn't exist. I think under the Carter administration, there were attempts to sequester the CO2 from coal plants, but I believe that there's nowhere in this country or in the world where clean coal exists. What happened on Saturday is particularly alarming, at least to my mind, that the U.S. joined Saudi Arabia and Russia in trying to minimize the dire International Panel on Climate Change's report on the approaching catastrophe of 1.5 degrees Celsius rise in global temperatures. We're already at a 1 degree rise, and we see the Great Barrier Reef in Australia dying. We see islands in the Pacific going under. What more evidence do we need?
Well, and it's not just that. I mean, it's not just happening in other countries. I mean, think about the intensity of the recent terrible fires in California. Think about Hurricane Harvey. Think about the variety of tragic events that have happened around this country recently, which are made more intense and more deadly and more hard-hitting as a result of climate change. So we're seeing evidence of the intensity already in this country. And, you know, what happened at this international meeting in Poland is, just to provide some background, the rest of the participants in these negotiations, this is ongoing rolling negotiations about how to implement the Paris Agreement, the rest of the world decided to issue a statement that they welcomed, this is a very important word they used, welcome the international report that is the most recent statement about the seriousness of climate change that expresses high confidence about the seriousness of what would happen if the world, in fact, warmed to 1.5 degrees, including, you know, heat waves and extreme rainfall and droughts and a variety of events. And the United States, along with Russia and Saudi Arabia, decided they would not agree to this language of welcoming this scientific report. They would only agree to note it, which is a diplomatic equivalent of saying, we know it's there, but we don't want to say anything nice about it. We don't want to basically embrace it. And, you know, this was really the U.S. reaction to being put in a tough spot. You know, the international community has decided to take steps to make the U.S. Either support the Paris Agreement or at least to point out the difference between the rest of the world and the U.S., and their response has been to say, if you're going to put us in that tough spot, well, we're going to reiterate the fact that we're withdrawing, we're going to emphasize fossil fuels, and we're going to make very clear that we're not with you. And, you know, to be in the company of Saudi Arabia and Russia here, what the U.S. has done is sort of open the door to let other countries off the hook. Saudi Arabia and Russia both pledged to support the Paris Agreement initially, and now what do we see? We see the three largest producers of oil in the world, that is Saudi, Russia, and the U.S., are all signaling that they're not going to support a scientific report that is at the heart of the international agreement. So this is not good news for international climate negotiations, and what I think the rest of the world is going to have to do is try to move forward anyway and hope for things to change in the future.
But if Russia were, it's a one-resource country, oil and gas, if it were to burn all of its oil and gas, and it has no other plans to diversify its economy, that would be the end of the world as we know it. And if you, then, of course, on top of that, Saudi Arabia, too, then what are we to do? I mean, when you say the U.S. is in this position, is it the U.S. or the Trump administration? I mean, if the rest of the world doesn't believes in global warming, where do we stand? Are we an outlier because of our administration, or are we an outlier because somehow the American people don't believe in reality?
Well, you raise a really interesting point. You know, of course, the Trump administration speaks for the United States government, and there's only one president at a time and one government at a time. And so in the international community, it is the Trump administration representing the country. But there is, of course, a variety of opinion in the country, and a variety of states are interested in continuing to support the climate accord that was struck in Paris. And prominently among those, of course, is California. And California has made very clear that it wants to lead the way into the future. And it is moving forward with a bunch of innovative policies. You know, it's created a cap-and-trade regime to control greenhouse gases. It's got policies to control GHGs from the transportation sector. It's got a renewable portfolio standard that's very aggressive. And so California and other states are modeling what you can accomplish if you really want to do something about this problem. So I think this is all meant to be a signal to the international community that the federal government, which at the moment is run by Mr. Trump, is not really representative of the entire country in this sense, in the sense that there are other jurisdictions, that several states and many, many local communities and cities and much of the private sector is still committed to the goals of Paris. And that signaling is very important. It tells the international community that there are lots of people in the country, lots of businesses, lots of governments that are still interested in moving forward.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Jody Freeman, it would seem, though, that as bad as Donald Trump is for America's position in the world and for the world's future, given the real and pressing danger of climate change, or as my friend Dave Freeman calls it, climate damage, the reality is that across the board, every day, his administration is undermining all kinds of environmental efforts that have started, of course, with President Nixon. The EPA, the Interior Minister, Ministry under Zinke, aren't they working day and night to basically, we talk about reversing the Paris Agreement, they're reversing everything that's been achieved in this country, are they not?
Well, you know, you're right that all of the domestic policies that were put in place in the prior years, in the Obama years, are being dismantled right now. They're trying to dismantle them. And they are the pillars of meeting our commitment to reduce our greenhouse gases and meeting our Paris pledge. So, yes, they're moving very hard to roll things back. I mentioned the standards for the old dirty power plants in the country, the standards for the transportation sector for cars and trucks. You know, we have leaders of the agencies in this country, the leader of the Environmental Protection Agency at the moment, the acting administrator, Wheeler, Andrew Wheeler. We have Ryan Zinke over at the Department of the Interior, each of whom has essentially disavowed our own federal government's national climate assessment, an assessment in which their own agencies participated. It's a very odd thing. I mean, Andrew Wheeler said he was, you know, not certain about it. Zinke went out and said, well, it was based on the most extreme scenarios, when in fact it's absolutely not the case. It was based on a whole range of scenarios. The leading scientists who wrote the report have come out and debunked what Ryan Zinke has said. So the leaders of the very agencies that by American law under American statute are supposed to protect human health and the environment have come out and questioned an unequivocal scientific report. So this just shows you that the Trump administration is very busy trying to undermine science, trying to undermine the foundation for doing something about climate change. I don't think we're going to see anything positive in the short term coming out of the administration unless they change their mind, which is always possible. But the federal government is not the place to look at the moment if you want to see action on climate change. The place to look is the states and the cities and the private sector. That's where the energy is. That's where the leadership is. I will note just before we end that there's one bright spot, which is there are new members in the newly Democratic House of Representatives that are interested in this issue and that are going to start to hold accountable some of the federal agencies and investigate what they have and have not been up to. And I think that's very important because they have been dismantling themselves, disabling science internally, and frustrating the legal mandates under which they operate. And I think that will come to light when we see the new Congress in the new year.
Well, Jody Freeman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Jody Freeman, who's the Archibald Cox Professor at Harvard Law School and the founding director of the Law School's Environmental Law and Policy Program, the co-author with Michael Gerard of Global Climate Change and U.S. Law. She also served as counselor for energy and climate change in the Obama White House. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the latest folly with Brexit, where the Prime Minister, Theresa May, is going back to the Europeans in the hope to make a better deal, which is highly unlikely.
German calling to the faraway town. Now war is declared and battle will come down. London calling to the underworld. Come out of the cupboard, you boys and girls. London calling, now don't look to us. Phony Beatlemania is bitten the dust. London calling, see we ain't got no swing except for the rain.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Harold Clark, a professor in the School of Economic, Political, and Policy Studies at the University of Texas at Dallas. He has been the co-investigator of the British Election Study, which is housed at the University of Manchester, where he's also a visiting professor. And he's the author of Affluence, Austerity, and Electoral Change in Britain. And his latest book is Brexit: Why Britain Voted to Leave the European Union. Welcome to Background Briefing, Harold Clark.
Hi, Ian. Good to talk to you.
Well, thanks for joining us, Harold. And this Brexit has turned into a millstone, an albatross around British politics. It's depressing the economy, creating enormous social divisions in the country. The only person I can see that's enjoying all this is Vladimir Putin. But this is a self-inflicted wound, it would seem, where the British political system simply can't deal with it. Now you have a prime minister who has had to cancel a parliamentary vote to ratify her Brexit plan, and now she's going to go back to the Europeans in the hope that they can make the deal a little sweeter to enable her to sell it to the British public. But the general consensus that I'm hearing from the UK is that this is never going to work, and that the only thing that could work would be a do-over, another referendum. What are you reading in the tea leaves, Harold?
Well, I think much of what you say is right, Ian. It's reminiscent, of course, of what David Cameron tried to do, before the first referendum, where he basically said that he would go to Brussels and get a new deal on membership in the EU. And of course, he wasn't able to do that. The EU really didn't have much interest in that. And so he came away basically just with crumbs. And I think that Theresa May will get even less in her attempts to try to negotiate a better deal. She's already been trying to do this, of course, for months and months and months. And what she came up with is clearly not acceptable to a majority of the members of parliament, and probably not to the majority of the electorate either.
But the other option that they keep talking about is no deal. And that's not an option, is it?
It's really a very chancy kind of thing. The debate has been cast, as you know, since the referendum, almost totally in terms of the economic impact of leaving the EU in various ways. And of course, the most extreme version of that is to simply crash out and see what happens. And, that would be a very extreme move. And so, potentially quite dangerous. On the other hand, there's a lot of uncertainty about the long-term consequences of EU membership or the lack thereof for the British economy. And we have to remember that anything we read from anybody, everybody is, to put it colloquially, everybody's got a dog in the fight here. So it's really hard to figure out what's going to happen, particularly in the longer run, where, quite frankly, economic theory and methodology is just not up to those long-term forecasts.
Well, I just heard an interview on the BBC with the former justice minister in this Conservative government, of Theresa May's. And he basically said, look, the only option is a new referendum. So she's not going to get anything out of Europe, as you've just pointed out. Crashing out would be catastrophic. So the idea of no deal is ludicrous and reckless. And that the only thing that made any sense would be to have a new referendum where you went back to the choices, Remain or Brexit. But this time on the ballot, it would be Remain. and whatever deal Theresa May comes up with. And that seems perfectly fair, and there's time to do it, is there not, before the March deadline set by the EU?
Well, it may come to that. It's really hard. You know, it's we're really in uncharted waters here. And, I mean, Theresa May well find herself out of her job well before any, you know, second referendum. And we may well have a another general election. So, in fact, you know, one of the dangers of another referendum, of course, is it may put us back in the same quandary that we're in now, that even if the people, you know, were to vote, say, okay, we'll go for some deal, she's not going to get another deal, basically. You know, so it's going to be some variant, a close variant of what's there right now. And we already know that Parliament's opposed to this, and I suspect people are as well. It's a real conundrum, like you said. It's reminiscent of you know, sort of great crises in British politics from you know, in historical kinds of crises. This is something sort of like the 19th century, which put the you know, the Tories being split on Ireland or the Corn Laws or what have you. This has turned into a huge thing, and I don't even see a second referendum as necessarily getting us out of it. So I just don't know.
So if indeed, and you say a new referendum would not just simply get rid of this nightmare and clear the deck, why not? I mean, I would think surely the average Britain has to recognize that this thing's been a catastrophe from the beginning. It was obviously a major folly of David Cameron's. I'm not sure he thought it through. He's casually offering up a referendum. And then they got stuck with this thing. They can't make it work. And why would anybody not recognize that this has been a nightmare from day one? And it just seems so obvious that this is a shooting yourself in the foot. It's not, they can't get out from under it. So the only way that I would see to get out from under it is to negate what happened in the first place.
Yes, well, I think that might be the one referendum outcome, you know, of a second referendum that would, in fact, you know, put the problem paid. But it's not clear to me, you know, exactly how this would come down. Right now, you know, it appears that until very recently, only about a third of the electorate wanted a second referendum. Of course, you know, this was just in terms of a remain or leave, a second referendum like that. But what you're suggesting would be something different. And the country remains very tightly divided on a remain versus leave, the sort of fundamental sort of choice. So, you know, I'm hoping to do some more survey work very soon. But quite frankly, it's been so chaotic, we haven't known when to go into the field even.
So when you say, though, that a new election might happen in the interim before the EU deadline, which I believe is sometime in March, isn't it?
March 29th.
So if, and obviously Theresa May delayed the vote in Parliament on her Brexit package because she knew she didn't have the votes. My understanding is that she doesn't have the votes, and it's really a question of whether she gets a catastrophic rejection with hundreds of votes against her or whether she gets a sort of, you know, vaguely damaging but nevertheless negative fewer votes. But either way, she's not going to get nobody's going to vote for her package from what I understand from the recent polls.
That appears to be true. She's not only falling short, but she's falling far short.
Right. So if this government falls, and there's been a lot of her own party that have defected, what's Corbyn going to do? In other words, is he going to get us out from under it? If I don't know. I mean, as I say, I just find this thing so extraordinary that a handful of people, you know, like Nigel Farage, a guy that came out of nowhere, whose party doesn't even have a seat in the UK, could cause so much damage. The outgoing Prime Minister Cameron, could sort of walk away from this orphan that he, this monster that he created. I mean, the whole thing strikes me, Harold, as a form of zombie politics.
It is. I think it's truly extraordinary. It's really a very bad mixture of ideology and personal political ambition, because within the Tory Party, people like Boris Johnson and some others, of course, their motivations are primarily in terms of personal ambition. And so this is sort of a big part of this whole thing. And, there's divisions in labor as well, not just ideological divisions over Europe, but personal, there's still a sizable contingent of new labor types who would really like to see Corbyn out as well. So this is, as you have said, just absolutely wild sort of politics, well beyond anything I've seen in, studying British politics for more than 30 years. So I wish I could tell you what's going to happen. But as I said to an audience at the Bush Library over at Texas A&M last week, this is a story where, I don't know what I have a good idea what's going to happen at all. It's hard to even write blogs about this.
Well, for the sake of our audience, Harold, let's try a little bit here in terms of, let's assume, for example, that May falls and there's a new election. Could he cobble together a majority?
I think the most likely scenario, if we have another election, is that Labour would emerge with a minority, like with a plurality rather, but not a majority of seats, and then would attempt to form a government using what we call confidence and supply. That is, they would rely on the tacit support of other parties, in particular the Scottish Nationalists and the Liberal Democrats, to form a government. They couldn't openly form a coalition with the SNP, but they could do the sort of Canadian confidence and supply model. And I think that would be that might be sort of the odds-on bet for what would happen with another election.
And, of course, in terms of coalition governments, one of the things that's frustrating Theresa May is the fact that she relies on the hard right-wing Ulster Democratic
Indeed.
Union, and they want Brexit, and that's totally screwing up the arrangement on the border with the Republic of Ireland that's a part of the EU.
Absolutely, absolutely. The fact Theresa May is in a very weak position, of course, with a minority government, especially a minority government relying on the Northern Irish DUP. And beyond that, she's in a very weak position because her image and her support in the country is so negative. One of the things we have found in our most recent surveys is that she is just really widely disliked, and not just amongst younger people, as was the case a year ago, but across the electorate as a whole, and across people regardless of their views on Brexit as well. And, so she just doesn't have that reservoir of pulling power, political pulling power, in the electorate that would actually help her to get some of her MPs in line and back her. So she has very little, going for her in terms of either the relationship with the DUP or her relationship with the voters right now.
And the same is to some extent true with Corbyn, isn't it? I mean, Corbyn was not a profile in courage in the first place when the Brexit vote took
place.
He waffled on that. So I can't see him being a sterling leader to get Britain out of this quagmire.
No. I mean, no, he is not. The one thing that we might say is that it's conceivable here in an election that Theresa May and the Tories might actually be saved by Jeremy Corbyn, because he is equally unpopular. His demographics are different. He remains very popular amongst young people, but across the electorate as a whole, he's got many detractors. But even with that said, the enormous divisions in the Tory party might well create a scenario where he would form some sort of minority government.
Well, Harold Clark, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you, Ian, and hopefully we'll chat again.
Indeed we will, because this thing's not going away. And again, I've been speaking with Harold Clark, a professor in the School of Economic, Political and Policy Studies at the University of Texas at Dallas. He's been the co-investigator of the British Election Study, which is housed at the University of Manchester, where he's also a visiting professor. And his latest book is Brexit, Why Britain Voted to Leave the European Union. And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back discussing the challenge of journalists covering the White House, where the occupant of the Oval Office has the bully pulpit, but is a serial liar.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Yohai Bankler, who is the Berkman Professor of Entrepreneurial Legal Studies at Harvard Law School and the faculty co-director of the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. He's the author of The Wealth of Networks, How Social Production Transforms Markets and Freedom, and co-author of the new book, Network Propaganda, Manipulation, Disinformation, and Radicalization in American Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Yohai Bankler.
Lovely to be again with you.
Well, thank you, Yohai. And today's program, we started out speaking with Jody Freeman, who is the former counselor for energy and climate change in the Obama White House. And we were talking about the climate change conference underway in Poland, where the United States has joined with Saudi Arabia and Russia in basically blocking a report on the state of climate change. And in terms of network propaganda, the President of the United States, as you well know, Yohai, has a powerful megaphone, the so-called bully pulpit, and we in the press have to cover him on a daily basis. So just a couple of days ago, he tweeted out a rather petulant critique of the French President Emmanuel Macron, saying, "Very sad day and night in Paris. Maybe it's time to end the ridiculous and extremely expensive Paris Agreement and return money back to the people in the form of lower taxes. The U.S. was way ahead of the curve on that and the only major country where emissions went down last year." The problem with that statement is that emissions actually went up last year. Under the Trump administration, the trend set by the Obama administration to reduce CO2 and therefore the effects of global warming have been reversed by this president. So what do we in the press do when we have a president who puts out such flagrant misinformation, if not lies?
So I think that's a critical question, but I also think we need to separate out to some extent the problem of climate denial in the U.S. from this particular president, because climate denial stems from a long-standing campaign primarily driven both by libertarians backed by ideology, but also by the carbon industries. And it's probably the core effort to undermine the role of science in public policy because of the tremendous wealth extraction that it threatens in the form of carbon, in the form of obviously oil, coal, etc. So focusing on Trump is important today, obviously, but focusing specifically on climate also helps you understand that Trump is not only a catalyst of disinformation, he's also a product of a much broader phenomenon of disinformation that has to do with making sure that policies that are actually counter to the public interest, not based necessarily on Democrats, Republicans, but based on the interests of a very small concentrated group of owners of particular industries and a broad public interest, as in this case, the environment. Now, when this background pattern of disinformation meets a president who is so willing to participate and repeat and amplify the lies, that creates a real question for newspapers. If you remember 15 years ago, there were studies that showed that newspapers covered climate science and climate denial as though they were two sides of an issue, even though the scientific consensus had more or less stabilized where we see it today in terms of the clear existence and human origin of climate change. And in response to that, newspapers began to cut down on saying such and so scientists or 90-some% of scientists say climate change is of human origin, recent, etc. And here are these couple of scientists who say otherwise without any clarification, which tended to support the climate denial and give them credibility. And that practice changed. But what do you do when there's an actual sitting president doing this? I think there the strategy can't be don't cover it at all. You can't not cover the president, particularly because these tweets are then connected to specific policy or diplomatic moves. But what's critical then is to frame, always frame and repeatedly frame what the president says in a sandwich of stating, here is the false statement that was made by the president in this context. Here's the statement. Here's why it's false. And make the process by which you arrive at that judgment very clear, very public. And I think it puts a lot of newspapers in an uncomfortable situation, because when you have one side consistently lying, and that side is part of a political party, takes a particular view, it's very hard to continue to feel like you're neutral vis-a-vis the political parties while at the same time constantly calling lies. So it's a challenge, but it's absolutely necessary.
But the so-called balance, which is the way that our media operates in this binary fashion, that in the universe of discourse there's only two equal and opposite positions, that was created by the newspaper industry, I think, not so much out of a sense of fairness and balance, to quote the mantra of Fox News. What they were really concerned about was that half of their readers were Democrats and half of their readers were Republicans. So in order not to alienate half of their readers one way or the other, they decided to come up with this idea of balance. And this has been an opening wedge for example, as you pointed out, climate deniers to be put on the same level of credibility as 97 or 99% of scientists in the globe. And in terms of, for example, creationism has been able to sort of become the nose of the camel in terms of claiming equal validity as the science of evolution. So that is, to my mind, has been a very destructive process in itself, because it prevents the possibility of people basically accepting fundamental truths. I mean, I don't know where to begin.
So let me push back a little bit on that. I think that the concept of balance in part comes out of, as you say, I agree, there is something when you have one newspaper towns or when you have three broadcast networks, making sure you don't offend too many of your members of your audience is certainly good business. But it's also the case that we had a strong public commitment to the idea of balance, and that there are competing perspectives on the problem, and that a small number of channels, whether it's broadcast or the one newspaper towns, owe it to their readers to provide balance. In fact, we had the fairness doctrine in broadcast for decades, built exactly on the idea that you should have a right of reply, that you should have balance between the two sides, and it was considered a Reagan anti-public interest, pro-market move to repeal the fairness doctrine. So we're in tension between, on one hand, balance sometimes producing anodyne, centrist, less diverse materials, but at the same time also reflecting the commercial interests of the firms. I think the critical failure of balance is not necessarily in the very idea as much as what happens when that professional institutional idea meets a highly asymmetric propaganda network. When you have businesses spending years denying climate, denying tobacco impact, when you have a party that systematically shouts voter fraud when all the evidence is against it, and now more recently, obviously, just with the extreme degree of lying from the president. So what happens is you have a set of norms which are partly about your own economic interest and partly about the genuine professional commitment to be neutral as among partisan view. And that meets a world that's so not neutral, so unbalanced, that in the pursuit of balance in the face of such highly asymmetric propaganda, you become, you in this case, mainstream media, by following balance rather than adapting to the propaganda structure, you become complicit and reinforce it. But I think it has more to do with the ways in which the idea of journalistic balance and neutrality was unable to adapt to the dramatic change in the degree of lying over the past 30 years that you see in right-wing media and partisan manipulation than it is fundamentally in the very origin of the institution.
So, Yochai Benkler, does that mean that we are essentially at the mercy of the personal predilections of media barons? For example, Bill Paley, who ran CBS, clearly believed in the truth as far as journalism can discover and dig up the truth. And, of course, he had in his stable, of course, he had some of the great journalists in American journalism, not the least of which was, of course, Edward R. Murrow, for example. So my understanding about the Fairness Doctrine, which you brought up, which was gotten rid of during the Reagan administration, I believe, at the personal urging of Rupert Murdoch, the Fairness Doctrine, I think, was a simple and elegant solution to the idea of a media baron deciding to use his media assets as a private soapbox. And what that meant was that if Rupert Murdoch had wanted to put out his propaganda when the Fairness Doctrine existed, his own network would be obliged to put up the equal and opposite argument. And that had the effect of leveling extreme political speech in this country, and I believe in many ways it was brought about by Roosevelt because he was being attacked by people like Father Coughlin and Colonel McCormack, a media baron in Chicago. So that's what we used to have. So are we simply at the mercy of the personal predilections of the owners of the media?
So the question of whether or not media ownership or as it were, freedom of the press is only the freedom of those who own one, has been a long-standing critique of advertising-supported media as the major medium that the United States relies on for decades. We went that path very early on. We had a period of strong public support for the press, but it was highly partisan and based on patronship, essentially. That's what the 19th century model of postal franking privileges and all sorts of ways in which the parties supported their presses. We pulled away from that with the rise of the penny presses and the emergence of the American broadcast system in the 20s that was advertised, and 30s that was advertisers supported. But the truth of the matter is that truthful reporting on issues of the day is fundamentally a public good without which we can't have democracy. And public goods, in the strict economic sense, are never supplied efficiently by markets. That's what makes them public goods. So whether it's national defense, whether it's law enforcement, whether it's basic science, all of these public goods are always fundamentally supported by public funding because the markets, we know, won't produce them efficiently. And in the context of the press, what we saw for a long time was that even though it was a commercial enterprise rather than mostly publicly funded, you had only three networks, so they had a lot of rents that they could then pour into news. You had one newspaper towns who were monopolies. They had rents. They could support news. You had family-owned newspapers that were willing to spend some of the profits down in order to achieve a better commitment to their own professional sense of identity as a newspaper-owning family. And those were always in tension. Once you had financialization of newspapers so that you no longer had the tension between professional values and financial values, you simply had extracting maximum value. Once you had so much more competition from so many more outlets, you saw more and more of a decline in the value of professional journalism relative to the newsroom and more of a push towards making profits. Nonetheless, when you look at the actual sites and the actual news sources that impact most of the population in the U.S., they all operate within a system that is partly driven by professional norms of journalism, partly driven by profit, partly constrained by competition from competitors who check the facts and make sure that you don't go off. And in this regard, the Wall Street Journal is a good example of an outlet that sells right-wing views in its opinion pages but is constrained by reality. What we see on the right is just this completely different competitive dynamic that not only liberates people like Murdoch or like Robert Mercer through the funding of Breitbart, et cetera, and various think tanks to just push their own propaganda. It also constrains anybody who tries to push against it and who would like to be conservative, but also at the same time based in reality. So yes, there is the longstanding concern with barons who run their own propaganda system, but I think there are also very deep market structure differences that have happened over time and professional norms that continue to be really important. That means we're not at the mercy of any of do we happen to have left-leaning and right-leaning robber barons who compete with each other. But rather, we actually have the majority of the population is still listening to media outlets that are strongly anchored in journalistic norms and operate in a competitive dynamic that forces them at least to be somewhat constrained by truth. And we shouldn't generalize the observations we see from the very distinct right-wing media ecosystem to imagine that that's what's happening across the media ecosystem. I think that's just not borne out by the fact and by the data.
Well, there is some comfort in that, I must say, Yohai, and the fact that we don't have a BBC in this country or an ABC as I have in Australia or CBC as I have in Canada, I think is to our detriment in the sense that they do set a journalistic standard of reality. But I just returned from Australia, where Rupert Murdoch owns about two-thirds of the press, the printed press. He, as you mentioned, he owns the the Wall Street Journal, but he's constrained to print reality on the in the news pages and his propaganda on the editorial pages. But in Australia, The Australian, which is the national paper that he owns, and The Telegraph, it's pure propaganda on the front page. It's just shocking how much he got rid of a conservative prime minister he didn't like. He decided he'd have enough of Turnbull, so he just turns against him, vilifies him, and then he brings in a new guy, a guy called Scott Morrison, who is evangelical, which is a very unusual for an Australian politician to be, like Mike Pence, but nevertheless, he's the new prime minister. And now on the front pages of the papers, you have this propaganda build-up. They're trying to make this guy into a personality and a leader, and it's just so flagrant. So I guess, having just really experienced real propaganda, I have to tell you, I'm a little relieved to see that Murdoch doesn't own too many more newspapers in this country.
So that's actually really interesting, because the BBC and ABC, as you say in Australia, set essentially the BBC system of a strong public broadcaster with dedicated revenue that is politically insulated both by law and by norms, is an enormously powerful model in terms of creating standard-setting journalism. But it's interesting that when broadcast fills that role, you see, both as you just described in Australia and in the UK, where The Sun and The Mirror, et cetera, where the printed press is full of tabloids of mind-bogglingly low quality. In the U.S., because TV never went that way, there remained a real role for print media to serve that role. And so I think what we need to understand is that, yes, there may be ideal models like the BBC model, where you have both good public funding and real independence from the government, because you always worry with public funding that you're going to get raised eyebrow regulation. We see that sucks some of the air out of the printing press, out of the print press, whereas in the U.S. it kept it going. And I think what we've seen, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that the American media ecosystem as a whole is perfect. It's not. Clearly, there are issues. There are constraints. You see failures. The fact that, for example, because Trump tweeted and sent troops, et cetera, the caravan was covered so heavily before the midterm, even though it was a non-story except of the propagandist move. There are clearly failures. But I think every country is different, and we developed our own alternative sources of anchoring in reality, given the absence of what would have been the most obvious correct answer, which is public funding with strong independence to create a real, a powerful, high-quality journalistic broadcast outlet with public funding. But we do have our own alternative.
Yohai Bankler, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure. Great to talk to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Yohai Bankler, who's the Berkman Professor of Entrepreneurial Legal Studies at Harvard Law School and Faculty Co-Director of the Berkman Klein Center for Internet Society at Harvard University. He's the author of The Wealth of Networks, How Social Production Transforms Markets and Freedom, and co-author of the new book just out, Network Propaganda, Manipulation, Disinformation, and Radicalization in American Politics. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
dressed in white with the man she loved. Standing along the side of a pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right. Another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305.